Well, there's nothing like an old rocker to get us moving around a little bit. That's Joe Cocker with Respect Yourself on Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. I'm host Sheldon Brown, and we've got technician Declan Curran here. And Take It From Us is brought to you and funded by Framework Trust. Now, our guest today is a prolific poster of valuable mental health information on Facebook. In fact, she's kept me so busy yesterday that I think it was almost half a day of exploring some of the posts on Facebook by our guest, Denise Calteau. She has her own page called Mental Health Consumer, Fiora Information Sharing, and I can confirm that she's sharing a lot of information. And it staggers me actually as to where Denise accesses all of it. Perhaps in our interview she'll spread some light on where her sources are and give us a bit of information about it. Denise has been a user of a variety of mental health services during her journey and has recently received another diagnosis, leaving her with yet another challenge to her well-being. So here's Denise to tell her story. I've had a coffee with her this morning, and yes, it's quite a story. So welcome to Take It From Us, and thanks for driving down from Helensville, Denise, to be live in the Planet FM studio.
It's nice to be here.
Well, that's great. Now, you and your family have a connection with Carrington Hospital, the Unitech site, the technical institute that currently runs here is resident in the old Carrington Hospital buildings. So what was your connection to Carrington?
Yeah, well, I just thought when I came in here, it's quite ironic, really, that I'm coming and giving a talk here about this because, you know, my very first contact with mental health services was actually for another family member, my dad, and he was in Carrington when I was a very young child. And so we would have visited him. And I also remember my mother, who was a psychiatric nurse a bit later on, they did a top hospital, and where all the different nurses in different hospitals, King's Seat and Carrington and whoever else was around at the time, Lake House and so forth, got together, and they all competed to see, you know, did all these, a bit taken off the top town thing, I think.
Yeah, well, we used to do a top town at Framework, actually, yeah, as part of our annual touch tournament. So I was just thinking of that. What was it like, though, for you as a young child to go into an acute psychiatric unit?
Well, I can't really remember all that much. I remember the top town thing quite a bit. I remember my mother getting her hips caught in the rubber tyre that they had to try and climb through. But we, you know, we as kids, we were all allowed to be given a go. I didn't have any thoughts as in, oh my goodness, I'm in a psychiatric hospital or anything like that. It was just a fun place to be with my family. And
right, but your father was a patient there.
Yeah, well, actually, I don't know if he was then. That might have been a bit earlier. The top town was a bit later.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you visit your father, though, in a psychiatric hospital?
Well, when he first came to Carrington, I would have only been about 18 months, but it had a huge impact on my life because our family was split up. And so for a period of time, I was separated from my family, and that had quite an impact on me as a child. So I was very young, 18 months at the time.
And separated from your mother as well as your father.
Yeah, like I went to stay with my granny. It's sort of quite hard from the family history to figure out how long that was for.
Right.
But I think it might have been about 6 months or something. So it had an impact, you know, separating from my siblings and so forth, because I was obviously traumatised after that because some things happened that made it obvious that I was affected quite a bit.
Well, I would say that just having to visit a psychiatric unit in the days when, I've got visions, memories of a lot of very old women sitting around in sort of hallways when I went to see my mother, and she was considerably younger than some of those women there. But Sunnyside Hospital was a very traumatic place for a young person to visit, and not the sort of introduction that most children would have had in their early life.
Yeah, well, I guess there's sort of there's two sides to that, because I remember I thought for years I was, when I was in hospital at a young age, my younger brother came to visit me, and he used to he said to me that I was wrapped as a, like, it meant so much to me that my baby brother used to come in and visit me, and years later I said something to him about how wonderful that was, and he goes, oh, I didn't really come to visit you, it's just that you had a table tennis table there.
Really?
So he wasn't infected on it. It was just a fun place for him to be, you know.
Right, so how old were you when he was coming to visit you in a psych?
16.
16.
Yeah.
So that was your introduction to mental health services, 16?
No.
No?
It was the first time I was committed into one of the institutions.
Right.
But my first introduction to mental health services was when I was 5. When I went to school, I think the teachers thought, holy crap, what have we got here?
Oh.
And I was sent to educational psychologists and so forth. And again, when I was... Oh, well, the funny thing is that the guy's conclusion was, because Mum wasn't working at that stage, was that, you know, she was an overindulgent mother, and that whatever was wrong with me was because I got too much attention and I should be just given less attention. And the following year, when I went to the same psychologist, my mum had started working, and the conclusion at that stage was that it was because she was a negligent mother and she was working, and working, you know, mothers were not good for children, so all my behavioural problems were because of that.
But she was working as a psychiatric nurse.
She originally started as a psychopaedic nurse.
Right.
And then went to psychiatric and then back to psychopaedic, yeah.
Yeah. Well, were the psychologists that were seeing you aware of the fact that you had a mother who was a psychiatric
nurse? Yeah. Yeah, I probably, because they interviewed the family and,
right,
you know, so forth. So, but we had the next lot of... We probably went and saw... mental health specialists over the time through my primary school years, because my behaviour was really extreme and out of control. I now have recently, at age 52, been given a diagnosis of autism, autistic spectrum disorder. And when I look back into those years of when I was in the primary school, to me, my behaviours were very autistic, and in fact, over the years when I had therapy and that, I often had comment from my therapist that I had that, gosh, you almost seem like you're autistic, but nobody really figured it out. But
when people said that to you, though, I mean, was that something that you spoke up about? And
well, I didn't know.
No. So how do you feel about, we were probably going to talk about the diagnosis of autism a little later in the show, but since you've mentioned it, I mean, how do you feel, 45 years later, that this diagnosis has been confirmed?
Well, I think that I fell grief-stricken more than anything else, because I see how I was as a youngster and my connections with mental health services, and I had a lot of potential. As a child, I was super, super intelligent, and I had a lot of gifts, as well as having a lot of behavioural problems. And so I feel sad that so much of that's just... I feel bereft, actually, that, you know, it could have been so very different if what I'd been offered as a child. But what did happen was, at age 11, I was medicated, and then at around that age, I started having regular contact with mental health services. I'd had a lot of behaviour modification and stuff like that, and we also had... I was also very vulnerable, because I was a very needy sort of... I was left to my own devices a lot, so myself and other members of my family were sexually abused, you know, and so we had that stuff going on. And then when I was 12, nearly 13, my brother was tragically killed in a car accident, hit by a train, sorry, and my auntie died a month later by a car accident. And we had already had a couple of people in, that were close to us when I was younger that died in car accidents, and one, my baby cousin, drowned. He was 2.5. But I didn't really have to... It didn't impact me, but it impacted my family, so that impacted our family unit. Mm. So these things were going on in the background.
Is a feature of autism... something of a lack of of feeling, emotion. Are you a little bit sort of protected from emotion and feelings?
Well, the funny thing is I don't know that they've got that right, to be honest, because I think that it might come across that way, because to me the main thing about it is that your senses are very reactive. Like, I don't cope with a lot of sounds, light, any of these things actually put a huge amount of internal pressure on me, and I react very badly to, you know, when I was younger, physical contact and stuff like that. And so whenever there's a sort of an emotional connection, it actually heightens my senses to a point where it becomes quite unbearable. And
Does that isolate you from connection and contact?
Well, the only time I ever feel really ease at peace myself is when I'm by myself, when there's no noise, no sound, like it's calm and light and stuff. So a lot of the... When people say that you don't connect emotionally, it's not that I don't want to connect emotionally with people, it's that I can't tolerate it. Mm. And I think that they get it wrong a little bit when they say, because when I do an empathy score, my empathy levels are very low. But really, it's because I think I disconnect so that I can, but it's really more about trying to reduce the intensity of my sensory input.
It sounds quite a conundrum, really, that... I mean, in my experience in mental health, we like to have connection. We like to socialise. In fact, I've got a quote here which says that there's a big survey that was done in America called the American Time Use Survey, and it shows that time spent in the company of others can plateau by our mid-50s, and we then spend an ever-increasing amount of time alone. However, if you're not heading to work or getting out and about each day, you may be missing out on important social interaction that you need to stay sharp, healthy, and live longer. So I suppose there's quite a lot of evidence that connection and having the opportunity for socialising is so important, and isolation is certainly one of the risks, isn't it, towards our mental health.
That's why I became unwell a couple of years ago again, was because I was living on my own and I became more and more isolated and more unable just to... You know, it's very seductive for me to be by myself because I feel okay. So for me to maintain connections with people, I'm having to push myself to be more and more uncomfortable. But the mistake that people make is that it's not that I don't want to be connected with people. It's that I can't tolerate it. And so the techniques that I've tried to do is, like, don't make it all or nothing. Like, I have to have a space where I can pull back to so that I can sort of re-level my equilibrium, and then I can come out a wee bit again.
You know. How's your equilibrium at the moment?
It's okay.
Well, Denise and I have met for the first time in a car park outside a Countdown supermarket, and everything. We had a coffee together, and it all seemed pretty good.
Yeah, well, I've been staying by myself pretty much for the last week and a half or 2 weeks, and so when I actually have enough downtime, it actually enables me to do stuff. I said to you that you built the way you connected with me to ask me to do this was that it actually worked very well for me. It gave me my first response was no freaking way, no, I can't. It's just too stressful. I can't do it. And then I have a bit of time to reduce that anxiety. And then you sent me the question, so I knew. And then I have a bit of time to think about that. And right. So it's actually, you might not have realised it, but the process that you did worked very well for me. And somebody asked me, because I'm close by, to go out for a coffee afterwards. And I just know myself well enough to know that I'll be shattered after this. Right. And that's okay, because I wanted to do it. But then I need to take that time out again.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more after a music break about, something of a conundrum again, in that you've been part of some documentaries. You've been on the Nutters Club. You do these things. You put yourself out there. So what have we got today, Declan?
Well, I was just going to say you're doing extremely well, actually, and coming across very well. So kudos to you. Today I've got a good little mix for you. The first one's by Lady Gaga, and it's called The Cure. And she basically said before one of her concerts, I've been through so much in my life, and I've seen so much, and you cure me every time with your love. And I thought it's quite an appropriate little number for here. So here is Lady Gaga with The Cure, and you're listening to Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM, broadcasting every Tuesday here live at 12:30.
You, 'cause you're tired, cover you as you desire. When you fall asleep inside my arms, may not have the fancy things, but I'll give you everything you could ever want. It's in my arms. So baby, tell me yes, and I will give you everything. So baby, tell me yes, and I will be all yours tonight. So baby, tell me yes, and I will give you everything. I will be right by your side. If I can't find your eye, I'll fix you with my love. No matter what you know, I'll fix you with my love. And if you say you're okay, I'm gonna heal you anyway. Promise I'll always be there. Promise I'll be the cure. Feet, your hands, your legs, let me take care of it, babe. Close your eyes, I'll sing your favorite song. I wrote you this lullaby, hush now baby, don't you cry. Anything you want could not be wrong. So baby, tell me yes, and I will give you everything. So baby, tell me yes, and I will be all yours tonight. So baby, tell me yes, and I will give you everything. I will be right by your side. If I can't find your eye, I'll fix you with my love. No matter what you know, I'll fix you with my love.
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6.
This is Sheldon Brown, host of Mental Health Radio Take It From Us, and we're talking today to Denise Calto, who has her own page on Facebook called Mental Health Consumer, Fiora Information Sharing. Denise has been very involved with the consumer movement. She's been involved in documentaries about mental health and about the consumer movement, and also been a guest on the Nutters Club as well. So there's this sort of dilemma, Denise, that some of your life is quite solitary, quite reclusive, and yet you're out there in these media, taking up media opportunities.
Yeah, it's a bit of irony, really, isn't it? Because for some reason, I'm often the way my mind thinks, I'm often very pioneering in my thinking, and that a lot of what I'm quite creative, and so I can see a whole lot of things that other people don't. Like, if there's 1,000 threads to something, you know, other people might see 100 of them, and I see the 1,000 at the same time. The difficulty that I have sometimes is, how do I get that information across to people? So I do get involved with, I've done a lot of mental health auditing and quality improvement and that sort of stuff as well, and I was a lecturer at the Polytech in Dunedin, where I was teaching people about mental health stuff, and what the struggle is how do you tell people about these 1,000 threads when you've only got time to tell them in the 100 threads? Which ones do you pick out? And that's one of like the communication difficulties of having autism. Because my mind will be going, I've got every single little detail, all these things, like, what do I actually tell people to get this information across? And one of the things that happens for me a lot is the things that I've been involved in and set up, I don't make myself very popular. And I often feel very socially separated from people. But people see me as achieving a lot and as being a leader. And I was involved in sort of re-establishing how the consumer network in Northam was sort of set up, and I became the chair of the trust there, and we umbrellaed it under another organisation. So I sort of took, you know, that organisation and just helped redesign it. At the end of the day, I was on my own. Because the other consumers who should actually be my peers saw me differently, and part of that is because I feel so pressured to get the information across and to make the changes that I'm not very good at maintaining the relationships in the process of doing that.
Is there a degree of frustration that people are not maybe keeping up with your vision or your thoughts?
It's not so much that they're not keeping up, it's that I'm desperate to. I see how important it is, and I see the whole picture, so I know where it's going and what it's going to look like in the end. And
but
why
you want it all to happen tomorrow?
Well, it's the change management. Like, how do you actually get people to get on board, and all those little nitpicky things that I find I have a real intolerance for.
Right.
And so I really need to have people. When I've been successful in my life is when I've actually had somebody there with me that's able to do that part of it, because I can't do it.
Right.
And so, but by excluding me completely as a person, other people are missing out, because there's something I have to offer, but I can't do it on my own.
I suppose our interview today on Take It From Us is something of a challenge. You've probably got 1,000 things that you could talk about,
yeah,
that you want to talk about, and it's, if you like, taking the outer skin off the onion and getting to the nub of the issues. But in terms of that media involvement, you have been a guest on the Nutters Club.
Yep.
That was, how long ago was that?
That was It was last year, sometime last year, because what we did, like maybe 3 or 4 years ago, part of my personal thing was like I couldn't figure out. I don't really feel a great sense of joy, and I struggle with, you know, wanting to live. I have a almost like a chronic suicidality, really. And if I can tick along, I manage to stay alive. But if things get a bit tougher, it's like I'm very keen to be. Like, I just can't do it anymore. And part of my exploration was what makes some people happy, like what makes life worth living. And the concept of life worth living hadn't really come up at that stage because it was like quite a few years ago, and I'd been thinking about it for the last 10 years, you know, like why do some people want to live and why don't I? And so I saw a thing on Facebook that some friends of mine had posted where they were taking one photo a day for 100 days of something that brought them joy or happiness. And and I just thought, gee, I'd really like to do that. I'd really like to do that, and I'd like to do it with some other mental health consumers. And so what we ended up doing was we set up a group of people and we took a photo a day for 100 days, but we met as a group every week at T1 at the Consumer Network.
In Northland.
And we, people selected one of their photos and put it up as, we expanded, so what brings you joy, what brings you happiness, or what are you grateful for? Because I thought a lot of people with chronic suicidality and feel like shit all the time, am I allowed to swear on the radio?
Yeah.
but there's always something you can be grateful for. So that, then what they'd do is every week everybody'd bring a photo, and it was to generate a discussion around this, like what makes life worth living. But I was a bit shocked for myself because I started to realise. That was when I started to realise that, oh, my photos don't have any people in them. Because what the brief was for ourselves was that it's actually when you feel the feeling, and when that feeling comes across, take a snapshot. Don't judge what the snapshot is. And if you haven't got a camera at the time, just remember it. Take a mental snapshot, and then maybe take a photo of something that represents it.
Or to take a selfie.
Yeah, anything at the time, and then bring that along, and then it generated a discussion, and the discussions that came out of that were amazing. Like, what's the difference between happiness and pleasure, and why don't some people feel joy, and where do you feel it in your body, and who, just all sorts of stuff.
It's quite a coincidence that you should mention photography, because coming up on July the 12th, in fact this Thursday, just 2 days out, Drive, which is an organisation in South Auckland in association with an organisation called CHAMP, are having a photo exhibition opening night. It's called My Unique Whānau, CHAMP and Drive photo exhibition opening night, and it's going to be at the Uxbridge Arts and Culture Centre, which is in Howick at 35 Uxbridge Road. But my understanding is that this is trying to capture how whānau have supported people with lived experience. This is going to be this Thursday at 6:30 to 9. It's going to, I think, it's 2 days from now. It's the Uxbridge Arts and Culture Centre at 35 Uxbridge Road, Howick. And it's hosted by the Drive Consumer Directions County's Manukau Group. So it's free. Get along there at 6:30. But,
I've put a photo in it.
Have you put a photo in it?
Yeah, I have. Oh, actually, it's the one that's on top. I noticed it's the one that I've put on top of my Facebook group.
Facebook page with the stones.
It's with the stones which I've made. So it's a photograph of something that I've made.
Right.
But it's got the words on it, like hope, courage and resilience, I think.
Right. Yeah, that image is becoming quite widespread, I think.
Is it?
Yeah, on Facebook. And I must also mention that when Denise and I met about an hour ago, she gave me a couple of her stones, and I'm really feeling very humble about them. It's a pity we're not on television, because they're two beautiful pieces of artwork.
I'm holding both of them now. We've got a little stone with hope and a lot of little round white circles, like little donuts around it, and some leaves coming off that. And one you could quite happily use as a paperweight. It says along the top of it, take time to enjoy nature. And we've got some beautiful red flowers. And in the centre, as well as having the white parts of the flower, we've got little gold circles and red inside it. So very beautifully done. Very impressed.
It's lovely.
I've got a whole lot of those rocks at the Kumeu Art Centre, because we've got a mental health group. The Connect people run a mental health group there. Once a week on Thursday from 1 till 3. So I go along there, and we really got into the rock painting and stuff. But I've always used my rock painting and as a way of spreading my messages from the Happiness Project, the messages of hope and stuff. And
the Happiness Project was a documentary.
Well, the Happiness Project was the project. There was the photography project. And there was a friend of mine her dream really was to take her script writing and stuff, because she's a nurse, but her dream was to become a movie director and so forth. And so she documented it as part of her dream and what she wanted to do. And the documentary's been to some international film festivals and everything now.
So it's called The Happiness Project?
No, it's called Crazy Happy.
Oh, Crazy Happy. And you can check that out online.
Yeah, it's actually on YouTube now, so you can watch it for free on YouTube. And it talks all about the Happiness Project and what we did and how we did it and so forth. And
right. Well, there's also a Happiness Experiment, which is run. I think the founder of that is Tamara Waugh, who works at the... at Changing Minds, which of course is a consumer organisation. So check out the Happiness Experiment as well. Take it from us, posts on the Happiness Experiment experience every day. So let's take another music break.
Well, actually, this one is very, very appropriate. It was released in 1978, and 7 years later, it became the theme to the Golden Girls from 1985 to 1992. I'm probably giving it away. It took an hour to write the song, but 40 takes to actually get the right one. Number 40, of course, was the right one. And I'd like to send this out to a special dedication for everybody out there, our family, our friends, who, when we're down on the gutter, are there for us unconditionally so that we can help ourselves climb back out again. Here is Andrew Gold. He's singing Thank You For Being A Friend. You're listening to Take It From Us on Mental Health Radio 104.6, broadcasting every Tuesday live at 12:30.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down a road and back again. Your heart is true, you're a pal and a confidant. I'm not ashamed to say, I hope it always will stay this way. My hat is off, won't you stand up and take a Cadillac. thank you for being a
Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And I'm host Sheldon Brown with technician Declan Curran on Take It From Us, and we're talking today to Denise Calto, who has her own Facebook page called Mental Health Consumer Fiora Information Sharing, and we did promise our listeners that we'd get back to this. So, how long's the Facebook group been running, Denise?
Well, I started it maybe 4 years or so ago, but then I became very unwell again a couple of years ago, and I wasn't able to do it. In fact, I found it very hard to do the Facebook page when I was not well, because when you're constantly trolling for mental health stuff and it's in your face all the time, it's actually very toxic. You know, to be thinking about these things all the time.
So how do you... I mean, that is a very relevant thing. I think those of us who work in mental health, there's a lot of negativity, isn't there? There's a lot of criticism of the mental health system and that sort of thing. How do you sort of protect yourself?
Not very well. The reason why I set this group up was because the consumer network up north had been going for quite some time, and it had always been part of the brief and my understanding that it would become part of what was done as part of the consumer network roles within the paid workforce.
What do you mean, not only in Northland but throughout the country?
Yeah, that, to me, that sort of seems like that's the ideal place, because information, as you know, is power. Like, I guess the thing that motivated me originally to set it up is I was very passionate about suicide prevention and trying to help set some things up, because I didn't feel that services responded very well to that sort of thing. And when the government started talking about suicide, when they changed, because it used to be illegal to talk about suicide publicly, and then they changed it and said, well, that's not working. We've got a lot of youth particularly dying, and so we need to start talking about it. And when they first started having meetings around the country for this, they were all service providers. And I just happened to come across at some point some information, because I'm trolling the net all the time just to keep informed, that there was a meeting in Whangarei. Now, I was, not only was I involved with several organisations as a consumer myself, but I was also the chairperson on the consumer network, and I hadn't heard about any of this meeting. And I'm thinking, how can they have discussions around suicide prevention when there's no consumers involved? And when I turn up and they're sort of saying, oh, you know, the way we do it is people that are really keen, they'll end up, the right people will end up. And I just thought it was a real cop-out. And there was other things like the euthanasia submissions and things like this that were coming up, and the information was not getting down to the people that you know, to consumers that these things
who are
affecting
them. Using the services.
Yeah, these are the people whose lives they're affecting, and they're not involved in the conversations. And so I just thought, bugger it, I'm going to actually start putting this Facebook group, and I'm going to start printing information about from the news and events that are coming up. My main thing was really about submissions, but as you know from my Facebook page, in the last couple of years, there's just been so much information about it, and it's almost an information overload for people. But part of what I wanted to do, because I knew how hard it was myself, I just thought, I want it all on one page. Mm. So people can go in, say, once a week onto that Facebook group and just troll through to find anything that's interesting to them that they may be involved in. And
so that's the Mental Health Consumer Fiora information sharing. I think on Monday, as I say, I probably spent a good part of my day checking out all those broadcasts. I guess you'd call them broadcasts, would you? What do you call them, Denise?
They're just... I don't know, like, because it's such a mixture, and people... I guess I'm at a little bit of a loss at times as to what's relevant, because what's relevant to me might not be relevant. I try to focus solely on what do I think some consumers might find this information useful and helpful.
Mm. I mean, we are facing the profile of mental health rising dramatically, aren't we? And I suppose that's been born out of the work that John Kirwan has done, that Mike King has done, the youth suicide statistics, which are the worst in the developed world, and now we have the government inquiry into mental health and addictions, which has raised the profile of mental health and addictions even further. So do you still feel that you're... Sorry, yeah, Declan, but do you still feel that your work with your Facebook page, Mental Health Consumer Fire, or information sharing is necessary? Or
well, I don't think that even with the review, I actually feel that consumers, that the information is not getting to consumers. Mm. I'll tell you why, is because at the moment I'm probably connected as a consumer, because I've been so unwell, like with about 6 organisations maybe or more. I didn't get any information about the review from any of them.
None of the public, where the public meetings were going to be and what time they were?
Nothing. No. I got nothing except from Connect. I got information about one meeting that was like the day after I got the information, and yeah, I had actually sent them information through my website like a month before. Mm. But so we've got there's something somehow that information is not filtering down to people.
The process wasn't particularly good. I had to ring the public relations people at Auckland Hospital or at Auckland District Health Board to discover where the venue was. I knew it was at the City Hospital, but in the information from the inquiry, it didn't say where the venue was. And this PR person was sort of quite surprised. She said, I'll have to get back to you. And she confirmed this at about, 11 o'clock on the day that that inquiry was happening. There was also a presentation by the government inquiry at Hearts and Minds in Northcote, which wasn't promoted at all. And
that's the one that I got the information from Connect.
Right.
But I saw 2 public notices in the week, you know, in that week, public notices in the paper. Not everybody has access, gets the newspaper, but I happened to see them to say about the one at the hospital. Now, there's no way I would go to a meeting at the hospital. I just wouldn't feel safe,
right?
Because of my personal experience. And there was one in Manukau at the Marae. And But I was thinking, they've only got two meetings in the whole of Auckland, because that was all that was being advertised. But there is actually a lot more. They just weren't advertised or...
Yeah, well, I'm still confused about that. And we actually interviewed the people from Hearts and Minds the week after they had heard these submissions and hosted the government inquiry at their premises in Northcote. So, yeah, that did seem a bit... So I guess what you're saying is that there is still vacuums in information for consumers, and you're trying to plug that vacuum.
I am, and I still think it should be a paid part of the consumer movement and, you know, the consumer peer support roles, because a big part of peer support is making sure people get access to information. Mm. And, I mean, it probably takes me at least 6 hours a week of work to do that, and I just do it. You know, and now that more and more people are starting to get onto that site, you know, I'm starting to get a few personal comments, you know, about saying, you know, like trying to blame me for what I'm putting on or whatever, but I don't...
Not supportive comments.
Yeah, there's been a couple where it's just sort of like it just makes me think, oh, yeah, I'm just doing a community service, so I don't really want to be personally attacked.
Don't shoot the messenger.
Don't shoot the messenger.
Yeah, well, I think that's...
It's also getting a lot of people that are signing up to it are actually not necessarily consumers. Mm. Because there's obviously a need for people working in mental health to get this information as well.
Well, I think your experience with the mental health system would underline that there is significant need for improvement in the services, and we haven't got a lot of time to sort of address that, but in Northland, your experiences haven't always been very therapeutic.
No, my experience in Northland, in Whangarei Hospital, in the acute unit and the subacute unit, was actually horrendous, life-changingly horrendous, and incredibly traumatic. And I feel very, very sad that that's the case. In fact, I felt gutted for all the work that so many good people over the years have been involved in, trying to improve the services, trying to, you know, make things. And it really is obvious that the risk management is a big consideration, and really people's experiences. I'll tell you a little story. Have I got time to tell a little story?
Yeah.
When I was in the subacute, I came across a young man. And I won't breach anybody's confidence or anything, but he was the area that people target. He was a rural guy, and he was a young guy, and he had been suicidal, and he had reached out and asked for help. And anyway, he was talking to me about what had happened to him, that he'd talked to his parents about how desperate he was for help, and his parents took him to mental health services. And then, like, to me, automatically, when somebody's asking for help, they're open to help. Like, that's just the nature, it's inherent. So there's this person that's open to help and wanting to be helped. His parents and the psychiatrist ended up sort of ganging up on him. He ended up being committed and being forced to do treatment and to do things that he didn't want to do, being forced to stay there. And anyway, the sad thing is that he'd been in hospital several months, and he was sort of getting ready to leave, and he said, I can't fucking wait to get out of here. He said, I'm never, ever coming back. I'll never ask for help again. Never, ever. I'll never put myself in this situation again. And I just felt so sad. I just felt so sad. And I said, look, I'm really sorry. It's not supposed to be like that.
Well, it's a terrible indictment on a place which is supposed to be therapeutic and based on recovery.
But the thing that I don't get is, how come when somebody's willing and asking for help, you know, what happened that he actually ended up feeling...
He'd never asked for help again. What about your own experience? Is it true that you had to escape from acute services?
Well, I ran away because I had some... I probably won't go into too much detail about it, but I'm actually so I'm so traumatized. I've been so traumatized. The last year of my life has been trying to overcome the trauma that I experienced when I was there, and I still feel quite shaky just thinking about it. And I'm too scared to go back to my home in Northland because I don't want to be under mental health services in Northland.
Well, I don't want to reignite that trauma, Denise. Let's go to our community notices.
Take it from us, Community Notice Board.
Yes, I've already mentioned the unique whānau run by CHAMP, which is the South Auckland sort of service providers organisation, and DRIVE, which is the DRIVE Consumer Direction in Counties Manukau. They're based in Manukau City. Their exhibition, and it turns out that Denise has submitted a photograph to that, which is getting quite a profile on Facebook. This exhibition is going to be run on Thursday at 6:30 through to 9 p.m. It's at the Uxbridge Arts and Culture Centre, which is 35 Uxbridge Road, Howick. So get along there. That event is free. We're also promoting a charity concert, The Chant of the Dragon, by Chinese Chow Shan Ensemble, Orchestral Ensemble, to raise awareness of mental health services among Chinese communities. This will be held on Saturday, July the 21st at 107 Nielsen Street, Onehunga. Starts at 7 o'clock. The recipient charity is our own community mental health organisation, Framework Services. Of course, Framework Trust is the funder of Mental Health Radio Take It From Us, and you can get tickets for $10 each on Trade Me. There is some delay in getting those out to mail out to you, so go to trademe.co.nz/browse and you should be able to find information on Chant of the Dragon on July 21. Also, a little later in the month, July the 27th, there's a Hearing Voices workshop with Deborah Lampshire. This is Friday, July 27, running from 9:30 to 4 p.m. It's at the Mental Health Education Resource Centre in Christchurch. Tickets are actually $99, so that's a bit of an issue maybe for some consumers. But Deborah Lampshire is a senior tutor with the Centre for Mental Health Research and Policy Development at the University of Auckland. She has considerable experience of mental health and episodes of psychosis, and was committed to the former Kingsseat Psychiatric Hospital. So she's a quite a depth of information and authority on hearing voices, on psychosis and mental health. You know Deborah Lampshire?
I've been to one of her presentations, yeah. But we're fellow Kingsseat people.
Right.
She was there a little bit earlier than me, though.
Right, so that was one of the other psychiatric hospitals where you had an experience of care.
Well, I've in my adult life, I've had probably 6 years as an inpatient all up in a few places, yeah.
Right. Yes, and so you've had 6 years of acute treatment.
Yes, yeah, like as an inpatient, yeah.
Right, and you lived in Dunedin and had some exposure to Ashburn Clinic as well.
I did, yes. When I was younger, I was at Ashburn Clinic, and then I was there again last year. I've actually had, because we're coming up to time, aren't we?
Don't worry too much. We've got a couple of minutes.
Yeah. Well, I'm just sort of thinking that because, you know, things have not all been doom and gloom. I've had some very good experiences and very good treatment, and, you know, my experiences meeting people that are in mental health services has been a real value to my life as well. So, I mean, Ashburn Clinic, you know, it was Ashburn Hall in my younger days. It saved my life. Like, I wouldn't have probably managed to do as well as I did if I hadn't been for them. Then my experience last year was quite different. The place is very different. I didn't cope very well. It didn't offer the same services, and I think they quite... I'm not really sure. They seem to be in a bit of crisis. The other thing is since I've been in Waitemata is that I've had the experience of being on peer support.
Right.
And that's been an incredible experience. Sue, I have a lovely peer support worker.
Well, maybe we should get you back, Denise, to talk about the positive things, peer support. I'm thinking, too, of your involvement with Creativity, which is an opportunity that's arisen through Connect, supporting recovery, which is wonderful, and I'm a great believer in creativity myself as a therapeutic tool. And, you know, it would be interesting to talk to you again about some of the strategies that you put in place to keep well and continue on, because it sounds quite a challenge, but I think, as you say, it's not all doom and gloom.
Mm.
My ex-journalist tendency to go for doom and gloom probably has come out today, and I apologise for that if that's the case.
No, it's just that I've got a really big story.
Yeah,
there's so much to say.
It is a big story, and I think that it justifies having you back if you would be happy to come down from Helensville again. We could even consider doing that next week. But, how are we doing, Declan?
I was just going to say we've got a short little bit of time, but what really bugs me is every time there is a road crash, that it's plastered over the news, so many fatalities, et cetera, and all these reaching out to try and reduce the road toll. And with the suicide thing, we're looking at nearly twice the amount. Twice the number. What do we do? We don't... It's still got that taboo to it. And until we go...
Well, there's a lot of stigma associated with suicide, a lot of impact on families, and we could certainly talk more about that.
I've got a lot of thoughts about that. I did a five-page submission about suicide to the original suicide prevention people, so...
Yeah.
Right. I've got a lot of experience and knowledge.
Yeah, well,
be fun to talk about.
Right,
as long as you play the MASH theme, "Suicide is Painless," as part of the music.
I'm sure we could organise that too. Well, thank you very much, Denise, for coming down from Helensville and being so courageous and telling your story.
Yep, we'll catch you next week.
Thank you.